a little early in the season for beach clothes, don't you think? He grins. Normally, whenever he looks at me for longer than a few seconds, I get nervous. But today, I force myself to keep my eyes on his. Warmth spreads over my whole body. It reminds me of standing under the heat lamps in my grandmother's house when I was no older than 5. It's amazing that eyes can do that, that they can transform light into heat. I've never felt that way with Rob. If you got it, flaunt it, I say, making my voice soft and steady. I see something flicker in his eyes. I've surprised him.
I guess so,
he murmurs, so quietly I'm sure I'm the only one who hears. Then he blushes bright red like he can't believe himself. He nods at my desk, which is empty except for a pen and the small square notebook Lindsay and I use to pass back and forth between classes, writing notes to each other.
No roses today? Or did your bouquet get too heavy to carry around?
I haven't been to any of my classes, so I haven't collected any valigrams. I don't even care. In the past, I would rather have died than be seen in the halls of Thomas Jefferson on Cupid Day without a single rose. In the past, I would have considered it a fate worse than death. Of course, that was before I actually knew. I toss my head, shrugging. I'm kind of over it. It's as though confidence is flowing into me from someone else, someone older and beautiful, like I'm only playing a part. He smiles at me, and again I see something moving in his eyes. Then he goes back to his desk and clasps his hands, gesturing for everybody to take their seats. As always, the dirty hemp necklace is peeking out from under his collar, and I let myself think about looping my fingers through it, pulling him toward me and kissing him. His lips are thick, but not too thick, and shaped exactly how a guy's mouth should be shaped. Like if he just parted his lips at all, your mouth would fit directly on top of it. I think of the picture from his high school yearbook, when he's standing with his arm around his prom date. She was thin, long brown hair, even smile. Like me.
All right, everyone, he's saying as people shuffle and scrape into their desks, giggling and ruffling their bouquets. I know it's Cupid Day and love is in the air, but guess what? So are derivatives.
A couple of people groan. Kent bangs in the door almost late, his bag flapping open and papers literally scattering behind him, like he's Hansel or Gretel and he has to make sure someone can follow his trail of half-completed sketches and notes to math class. His black and white checkered sneakers peek out under his oversized khakis. Sorry, he mutters breathlessly to Mr. Daimler. Emergency at the tribulation, printer problems, malignant paper tumor in tray 2, had to operate immediately or risk losing it. As soon as he makes it halfway up the aisle to his seat, his math textbook, which was riding higher and higher on a wave of crumpled paper inside his open bag, pops out and slams to the floor, and everybody laughs. I feel a surge of irritation. Why is he always such a mess? How hard is it to zip up a bag? He catches me looking at him, and I guess he mistakes my facial expression for concern because he grins at me and mouths, "Walking disaster," as though he's proud of it. I turn my attention back to Mr. Daimler. He's standing at the front of the room with his arms crossed, his expression fake serious. That's another thing I like about him. He's never really mad.
Glad the printer pulled through, he says, raising his eyebrows.
His sleeves are rolled up and his arms are tan, or maybe that's just the color of his skin, like burnt honey.
As I was saying, I know there's a lot of excitement on Cupid Day, but that doesn't mean we can just ignore the regular
Cupids! Someone squeals and the class dissolves into giggles. Sure enough, there they are, the devil, the cat, and the pale white angel with her big eyes. Mr. Daimler throws up his hands and leans against his desk.
I give up, he says.
Then he turns his smile to me for just a second, but long enough for my whole body to light up like a Christmas display. The angel delivers 3 of my roses, the ones from Rob, Terraflute, and Elodie, and then keeps sorting methodically through her bouquet, flipping each card over and checking for my name.
There's something careful and sincere about her movements, like she's super focused on doing everything correctly. As she reads off the addressee, she mouths the name quietly to herself, wonderingly, as though she can't believe there are so many people in the school, so many roses to deliver, so many friends. It's painful to watch, and I stand up abruptly, grabbing the cream and pink rose from her hands. She jumps back, startled. "It's mine," I say. "I recognize it." She nods at me, wide-eyed. I doubt a senior has ever spoken to her in her life. She begins to open her mouth. I lean in so that no one else can hear me. "Don't say it," I say, and her eyes go even wider. I can't stand to hear her say it's beautiful. I can't stand it when the rose and everything else is all garbage now. Meaningless. It's just going in the trash. I mean it, too. As soon as Mr. Daimler ushers the Cupids out the door, everyone in class still giggling and showing off the notes their friends have written them and trying to predict how many roses they can expect by the end of the day, I scoop up my roses and sail to the front of the classroom, dumping them in the big trash can right next to Mr. Daimler's desk. Instantly, the giggling stops. Two people gasp, and Chrissy Walker actually makes the sign of the cross like I've just crapped on a Bible or something. That's how big of a deal the roses are. Becca Roth half rises from her seat like she wants to dive in after the roses and rescue them from the fate of being crushed under paper and pencil shavings, failed quizzes, and empty soda cans. I don't even look in Kent's direction. I don't want to see his face. Becca blurts.
You can't just throw out your roses, Sam. Someone sent those to you.
Yeah, Chrissy pipes up. It's so not done. I shrug. You can have them if you want. I gesture to the trash can, and Becca casts a wistful look in that direction. She's probably trying to decide whether the social boost she would get from having four extra roses is worth the ego hit she would take for dumpster diving to get them. Mr. Daimler smiles, winks at me.
You sure you want to do that, Sam?
He raises upturned hands.
You're breaking people's hearts right and left.
Oh, yeah? All of this will be gone, vanished, erased tomorrow, and tomorrow will be erased the next day, and the next day will be erased after that, all of it wiped clean and spotless. What about yours? It goes dead silent in the room. Somebody coughs. I can tell Mr. Daimler doesn't know whether I'm deliberately baiting him or not. He licks his lips nervously and runs a hand through his hair.
What?
Your heart. I pull myself up so I'm sitting on the corner of his desk, my skirt riding up almost to my underwear. My heart is beating so fast it's a hum. I feel like I'm skimming above the air. Am I breaking it?
Okay. He looks down, fiddles with one of his sleeves. Take a seat, Sam. It's time to get started.
I thought you were enjoying the view.
I lean back a little and stretch my arms above my head. There's a kind of electricity in the air, a zipping, singing tension running in all directions. It feels like the moment right before a thunderstorm, like every particle of air is extra charged and vibrating. A student in the back of the class laughs and another one mutters, "Jesus." Maybe it's my imagination, but I think I recognize Kent's voice.
Mr. Daimler looks at me, his face dark.
Sit.
If you insist.
I swivel off the edge of the desk and move around to his chair, then sit down and cross my legs slowly, folding my hands in my lap. Little giggles and gasps erupt around the classroom, bursts of sound. I don't know where this is coming from, this feeling of complete and total control. Up until a few months ago, I still turned to jello whenever a guy talked to me, including Rob. But this feels easy, natural, like I've slipped into the skin that belongs to me for the first time in my life.
In your own chair.
Mr. Daimler's practically growling, and his face is dark red, almost purple. I've made him lose it. Probably a first in Thomas Jefferson history. I know that in whatever game we're playing, I've just won a point.
The idea makes my stomach drop a little, not in a bad way, more like at the moment right before you reach the highest part of the roller coaster, when you know that at any second you'll be at the very top of the park, looking down over everything, pausing there for a fraction of a second, about to have the ride of your life. It's the dip in your stomach right before everything goes flying apart in a blast of wind and screaming, right before you let go completely. The laughter in the room grows to a roar. If you were standing outside, you might mistake it for applause. For the rest of the class, I keep quiet, even though people keep whispering and breaking out into giggles, and I get 3 notes sent my way. One of them is from Becca and says, "You are awesome." One of them is from Hannah Gordon and says, "He's so hot." Another one lands in my lap, all balled up like trash, before I can see who threw it in my direction. It says, "Whore." For a moment, I feel a hot flush of embarrassment, like nausea or vertigo, but it passes quickly. None of this is real anymore. I'm not even real anymore. A 4th note arrives just before class ends. It's in the form of a miniature airplane, and it literally sails to me, landing with a whisper on my desk, just as Mr. Daimler turns back from writing an equation on the board. It's so perfect, I hate to touch it. But I unfold its wings, and there's a message written in neat block letters. "You're too good for that." Even though there's no signature, I know it's from Kent. And for a second, something sharp and deep goes through me, something I can't understand or describe, a blade running up under my ribs and making me almost gasp for breath. I shouldn't be dead. It shouldn't be me. I take the note very carefully and tear it in half, then I tear it in half again. We've been restless all class, and Mr. Daimler gives up 2 minutes before the bell rings. "Don't forget, test on Monday, limits and asymptotes." He goes to his desk and leans on it, looking tired. There's a mass exhalation, a collective sigh of coats rustling and chairs scraping against the linoleum. "Samantha Kingston, please see me after class." He's not even looking at me, but the tone of his voice makes me nervous. For the first time, it occurs to me that I could really be in trouble. Not that it matters, but if Mr. Daimler makes me sit through a lecture about responsibility, I'll die of embarrassment. I'll die again. "Good luck," Becca mouths to me on her way out. We're not even friends. Lindsay calls her the turkey jerk because she eats turkey sandwiches every single day. But the fact that she says it makes the knot ease up in my stomach. Mr. Daimler waits until the last student files out of the classroom. I see Kent hovering at the doorway out of the corner of my eye, and then walks slowly to the door and closes it. Something about the way the door clicks, so final, so quick, makes my heart skip a beat. I close my eyes for a second, feeling like I'm back in the car with Lindsay on Fallow Ridge Road with the misty headlights of a second car bearing down on us in the darkness, an accusation. "They always swerve first," she'd said. But at that second, I understand with total and perfect clarity that that's not why she did it, why she does it. She does it for that one thrilling moment when you don't know, when you come up against someone who doesn't swerve and instead find yourself plummeting off the road into the darkness. When I open my eyes, Mr. Daimler has his hands on his hips. He's staring at me. "What the hell were you thinking?" The harshness in his voice startles me. I've never been cursed at by a teacher. I don't know what you're talking about. My voice comes out sounding thinner, younger than I wanted it to. "The shit back there? Right there in front of everybody? What were you thinking?" I stand up so I'm not just sitting there looking up at him like a little kid. My legs are wobbly and I have to steady myself with one hand against the desk. I take a deep breath, trying to pull it together. It doesn't matter. All of it will be erased, cleaned away. "I'm sorry," I say, feeling a little bit stronger. "I really don't know what you're talking about. Did I do something wrong?" He looks toward the door and a muscle twitches in his jaw. Just that. That little twitch returns all my confidence. I want to reach out and touch him, put my fingers in his hair.
You could get in a lot of trouble, you know, he says, not looking at me.
You could get me in a lot of trouble. The first bell rings. Class is officially over now. The singing feeling returns to my blood, to the air. I step carefully around my desk and walk straight to the front of the classroom. I stop when we're only a few feet away from each other. He doesn't back away. Instead, he finally looks at me. His eyes are so deep and full of something, it almost frightens me off. But it doesn't. I lean casually against Becca's desk, tipping backward and resting on my elbows so I'm totally laid out in front of him, chest, legs, everything. My head feels like it has floated away from my body. My body feels like it has floated away from my blood, like I'm just dissolving into energy and vibration. I don't mind trouble, I say in my sexiest voice. Mr. Daimler is staring into my eyes, not looking at the rest of me, but somehow I know that it's an effort.
What are you doing?
My skirt is riding so high I know my underwear is showing. It's a pink lace thong, one of the first I've ever owned. Thongs always make me feel like there is a rubber band up my butt, but last year, Lindsay and I bought the same pair at Victoria's Secret and swore to wear them. The words come to me from a script from a movie. I can stop if you want. My voice comes out breathy, but not because I'm trying. I am no longer breathing. Everything, the whole world, freezes in that moment while I wait for his response. But when he speaks, he sounds tired, annoyed, not at all what I was expecting.
What do you want, Samantha?
The tone of his voice startles me, and for a second my mind spins blankly. He's staring at me with a look of impatience now, as if I've just asked him to change my grade. The second bell rings. I feel like at any moment he'll dismiss me, remind me about the quiz on Monday. I've somehow lost control of the situation, and I don't know how to fix it. The vibration in the air is still there, but now it feels ominous, like the air is full of sharp things getting ready to drop. I want you. I don't mean for it to come out so uncertain. This is what I want. This is what I've been wanting, Mr. Daimler. My mind keeps spinning in a blind panic, and I can't remember his first name, and I feel like laughing hysterically. I'm stretched out half-naked in front of my math teacher, and I don't know his name. Then it comes to me. Evan. I want you, Evan, I say a little more boldly. It's the first time I've ever used his first name. He stares at me for a long time. I start to get nervous. I want to look away or pull down my skirt or cross my arms, but I force myself to stay still. What are you thinking about? I finally ask. But instead of answering, he just walks straight to me and puts his arms on my shoulders, pushing me backward so I tip over onto Becca's desk. Then he's bending over me, kissing me, and licking my neck and ear and making little grunting noises that remind me of Pickle when he has to pee. Pressed against him, I feel tiny. His arms are strong, groping all over my shoulders and arms. He slides one hand up my shirt and squeezes my boobs, one after the other, so hard I almost cry out. His tongue is big and fat. I think, I'm kissing Mr. Daimler, I'm kissing Mr. Daimler. Lindsay will never believe it. But it doesn't feel anything like I've imagined. His 5 o'clock shadow is rough on my skin, and I have this horrible thought that this is what my mom feels when she kisses my dad. When I open my eyes, I see the plain speckled ceiling tiles of the classroom, the ceiling tiles I've spent hours and hours staring at this semester, and my mind starts circling around them, counting, like I'm a fly buzzing somewhere outside my body. I think, how can the same ceiling still be here while this is happening? Why isn't the ceiling coming down? All of a sudden, it's not fun anymore. All those sharp, glittery things drop out of the air at once, and at the same time, something drops deep inside of me. I feel like I'm sobering up after drinking all night. I put my hands on his chest and try to push him off, but he's too heavy, too strong. I can feel his muscles under my fingertips. He used to play lacrosse in high school, Lindsay and I found out, and above that, a fine layer of fat. He's leaning on me with his full weight, and I can't breathe. I'm crushed underneath him, my legs split apart on either side of his hips, his stomach warm and fat and heavy on mine. I wrestle my mouth away from his. We can't do this, here. The words just pop out without my meaning them to. What I wanted to say was, we can't do this, not here, not anywhere. What I wanted to say was, stop. He's breathing hard, still staring at my mouth. There's a tiny bead of sweat at his hairline, and I watch it trace its way across his forehead and down to the tip of his nose. Finally, he pulls away from me, rubs his hand over his jaw, and nods. The moment he's off me, I scrabble up to my feet and tug down my skirt, not wanting him to see that my hands are shaking.
You're right, he says slowly. He gives a quick shake of his head as though trying to rouse himself from sleep.
You're right. He takes a few steps backward and turns his back to me. For a second, we just stand there, not speaking. My brain is all static. He's only a few feet away from me, but he looks hopelessly, impossibly far, like someone you can just make out distantly, a silhouette in the middle of a blizzard.
Samantha.
Finally, he turns back to me, rubbing both eyes and sighing like I've exhausted him.
Listen, what happened here, I don't think I need to tell you that this has to stay strictly between you and me.
He's smiling at me, but it's not his normal, easy smile. There's no humor in it.
This is important, Samantha.
You understand? He sighs again.
Everyone makes mistakes.
He trails off watching me.
Mistakes,
I repeat, the word pinging around in my head. I'm not sure whether he thinks he made a mistake or I did. Mistake, mistake, mistake. A strange word, stinging, somehow. Mr. Daimler's mouth, eyes, nose, his whole face seems to be rearranging itself into unfamiliar patterns, like a Picasso painting.
I need to know that I can count on you.
Of course you can. I hear myself say, and he looks at me, relieved. Like if he could, he would pat me on the head and say, good girl. After that, I just stand there for a bit. I'm not sure if he's going to come around and kiss me or give me a hug. It seems insane just to leave, to pick up my stuff and go as though nothing's happened. But after he blinks at me for a bit, he finally says,
you're late for lunch.
And now I know I really am being dismissed, so I grab my bag and go. As soon as I'm out in the hall, I lean up against a wall, grateful for the feeling of the stone against my back. Something bubbles up inside me, and I don't know whether I should jump up and down or laugh or scream. Fortunately, the halls are empty. Everybody's already at lunch. I take out my phone to text Lindsay, but then I remember that we're in a fight. There's no text from her asking if I want to go to Kent's party. She must still be mad. I'm not sure whether I'm fighting with Elodie, too. Remembering what I said in the car makes me feel horrible. I think about texting Allie. I'm pretty sure she's not mad at me, at least. And I spend a long time trying to figure out how to word it. It feels weird to write, I kissed Mr. Daimler. But if I write Evan, she won't know who I'm talking about. Evan Daimler feels wrong, too, and besides, we did more than just kiss. He was on top of me. In the end, I drop my phone back into my bag without writing anything. I figure I'll just wait until I've made up with Lindsay and Elodie and tell them in person. It'll be easier that way, easier to make it sound better than it was, and I'll get to see their faces. The thought of how jealous Lindsay will be makes the whole thing more than worth it. I put some concealer on my chin to cover the red spots where Mr. Daimler's face gave me an exfoliation I didn't need, and then I head to lunch. You can't judge a book by its steel-toed combat boots. When I march into the cafeteria 10 minutes late, our usual table is empty.
and I know that I have been officially and deliberately ditched. For a fraction of a second, I can feel everyone's eyes lift in my direction, staring. I bring my hand up to my face without meaning to, suddenly terrified that everyone will see the rawness on my chin and know what I've been doing. I duck out into the hall again. I need to be alone. I need to pull it together. I head for the bathrooms, but as I get close, two sophomores, Lindsay calls them s'mores because they're always stuck together and more than two will get you sick, come bursting out of the door giggling, arm in arm. Lunch is prime bathroom traffic time. Everyone needs to reapply lip gloss, complain about feeling fat, threaten to upchuck in one of the stalls. And the last thing I need right now is a steady stream of stupid. I head to the old bathroom at the far end of the science wing. Hardly anyone uses it since a newer bathroom with toilets that don't clog 24/7 was installed last year between the labs. The farther I get from the cafeteria, the more the roar of voices drops away until they sound just like the ocean from far away. I get calmer with every step. My heels beat a steady rhythm on the tile floor. The science wing is empty, as expected, and smells, as always, like chemical cleaners and sulfur. Today, there's something else, though. The smell of smoke and something earthier, more pungent. I push against the bathroom door, and for a second, nothing happens. I push harder, and there's a grating sound. I jam my shoulder against the door, and finally it swings open, carrying me inside with it. Instantly, I hit my knee on a chair that has been propped up against the doorknob, and pain shoots up my leg. The smell in the bathroom is much stronger. I drop my bag and lean over, clutching my knee. Shit! What the hell? The voice makes me jump. I didn't realize there was anyone else in the bathroom. I look up and Anna Cartulo's standing there, holding a cigarette in one hand. Jesus, I say, you scared me. I scared you? She leans up against the counter and taps her ashes in the sink. You, like, forced your way in. Don't you know how to knock? Like I've just broken into her house. Sorry I ruined your party. I make a half-hearted move for the door. Wait. She holds up a hand looking nervous. Are you gonna tell? Tell what? About this. She inhales and blows a cloud of smoke. The cigarette she's smoking is extra thin and it looks like she rolled it herself. Then it hits me. It's a joint. The weed must be mixed with a lot of tobacco because I didn't recognize the smell immediately, and I come home with my clothes reeking of it after every party. Elodie once said it was lucky my mom never came into my room, or she would think I was dealing pot out of my dirty laundry hamper. So what? You just come in here and smoke your lunch? I'm not saying it to be mean, but it comes out that way. Her eyes dart to the floor for a second, and then I notice an empty sandwich bag and a half-eaten bag of chips sitting on the tiles. It occurs to me I've never once seen her in the cafeteria. She must eat her lunch here every day. Yeah, I like the decor. She sees me looking at the sandwich bag, stubs out the joint, and crosses her arms. What are you doing here anyway? Don't you have... She stops herself, but I know what she's about to say. Don't you have friends? I had to pee, I say. This is obviously a lie, since I've made zero effort to use the toilet, but I'm too tired to come up with a different excuse, and she doesn't ask me for one. We stand there in awkward silence for a bit. I've never spoken a word to Anna Cartulo in my life, at least in the life I had before the car crash, beyond one time when I said, "Don't call her an evil wench," after she called Lindsay an evil wench. But I'd rather stay here with her than go out into the hall. Finally, I think, screw it, and I sit down in the chair and prop my leg up on one of the sinks. Anna's eyes are slightly unfocused now, and she's more relaxed, slouching up against one of the walls. She nods at my knee. Looks swollen. Yeah, well, somebody stuck a chair right inside the door. She starts giggling. She's definitely stoned. Nice shoes. She raises her eyebrows at my feet, which are dangling over one of the circular sinks. I can't tell if she's being sarcastic. Hard to walk in, huh? I can walk, I say too quickly. Then I shrug. Short distances, anyway. She snorts and then covers her mouth.
I bought them as a joke. I don't know why I feel the need to defend myself to Anna Cartullo, but I guess nothing is the way it's supposed to be today. All the rules have pretty much gone out the window. Anna's relaxing, too. She acts like it's not weird that we're hanging out in a bathroom the size of a prison cell when we should be at lunch. She hops up on the counter and wiggles her feet in my direction. Unsurprisingly, she's not wearing anything Cupid Day related. She has on a couple of layered black tank tops and an open hoodie. Her jeans are fraying at the hem and have a safety pin through the fly where they're missing a button. She's wearing enormous wedge round-toe boots that kind of look like Doc Martens on crack. You need a pair of these. She clicks her heels together, a punked-out Dorothy trying to get home from Oz. Most comfortable shoes I ever owned. I look at her like, yeah, right. She shrugs. Don't knock them till you try them. Okay, then. Pass them over. Anna looks at me for a long second like she's not sure if I'm serious. Look. I kick my shoes off. They hit the ground with a clatter. We'll trade. Anna bends over wordlessly, unzips her boots, and wiggles out of them. Her socks are rainbow striped, which surprises me. I would have expected skulls or something. She peels these off next and balls them up in one hand, starting to pass them to me. Ew! I wrinkle my nose. No, thank you. I'd rather go commando. She shrugs, laughing. Whatever. When I zip into her boots, I realize she's right. They are super comfortable, even without socks. The leather is cool and very soft. I admire them on my feet. I feel like I should be terrorizing children. I knock the bulging steel-tipped toes together, which makes a satisfying clicking sound. I feel like I should be turning tricks. Anna has maneuvered her way into my heels and is now teetering experimentally around the bathroom, arms out like she's on a tightrope. Same size feet, I point out, though it's obvious. 8.5. Pretty common. She glances over her shoulder at me like she's considering saying something else, then reaches under the sink and pulls out her bag. A beat-up patchwork hobo thing that looks like she made it herself. She extracts a small Altoids tin. Inside, there's a dime bag of weed. I guess Alex Lament is good for something. Rolling papers and a few cigarettes. She starts rolling another spliff, carefully balancing her life studies packet on her lap to use as a tray. Side note. So far, I've seen the life studies packet used as 1, an umbrella, 2, a makeshift towel, 3, a pillow, and now this. I have never actually seen anyone study with it, which either means that everyone who graduates from Thomas Jefferson will be totally unprepared for life, or that certain things can't be learned in bullet point format. Her fingers are thin and move quickly. She's obviously had practice. I wonder if that's what she and Alex do together after they've had sex. Just lie there, side by side, smoking. I wonder if she ever thinks about Bridget when they're doing it. I'm tempted to ask. Stop staring at me, she says without looking up. I'm not. I tilt my head back and stare at the vomit-colored ceiling, am reminded of Mr. Daimler and look back at her. There aren't too many other options. No one asked you to come in here. Some of the edge returns to her voice. Public property. There's a split second when her face goes dark, and I'm sure she's going to freak out, and this will be the end of our shiny, happy time together. I rush on. It's seriously not that bad in here. For a bathroom, you know. She looks at me suspiciously, like she's sure I'm only baiting her so I can make fun of her afterward. You could get some pillows for the floor. I look around. Decorate a bit or something. She ducks her head, concentrating on her fingers. There's this artist I've always liked. The guy who does all the stairs going up and down at the same time. M.C. Escher? She glances up, obviously surprised I know who she's talking about. Yeah, him. A smile flits across her face. I was thinking of, I don't know, hanging one of his prints in here. Just taping it up, you know, for something to look at. I have, like, 10 of his books in my house, I blurt out, glad she's not going to stay mad and kick me out of the bathroom. My dad's an architect. He's into that stuff.
Anna rolls up the joint, licks the seam, and finishes it off with a few twists of her fingers. She nods at the chair.
If you're going to sit in that, you can at least block the door. That way it's private property.
The chair grates against the tile floor as I scoot backward against the door, and both of us wince, catch ourselves wincing, and laugh. Anna pulls out a purple lighter with flowers on it, not the lighter I expected of her, and tries to spark the joint. The lighter sputters a few times and she throws it down, cursing. The next time she rummages through her bag, she pulls out a lighter in the shape of a naked female torso. She presses on the head and little blue flames come shooting out the nipples. Now that is the kind of lighter I would expect Anna Cartullo to have. Anna's face gets serious and she takes a long pull of the joint, then stares at me through the cloud of blue smoke.
So? She says. Why do you guys hate me?
Of all the things I expected her to say, it's not this. Even more unexpected, she holds the spliff out in my direction, offering me some. I hesitate for only a second. Hey, just because I'm dead doesn't mean I'm a saint.
We don't hate you.
It doesn't come out convincingly. The truth is, I'm not sure. I don't hate Anna, really. Lindsay's always said she does, but it's hard to know what Lindsay's reasons are for anything. I take a hit off the joint. I've only smoked weed once before, but I've seen it done 100 times. I inhale and my lungs are full of smoke, a heavy taste like chewing on moss. I try to hold my breath the way you're supposed to, but the smoke tickles the back of my throat. I start coughing and hand the joint back.
Then what's the reason?
She doesn't say, for all the shitty things you've done. For the bathroom graffiti, for the fake email blast sophomore year, Anna Cartullo has chlamydia. She doesn't have to. She passes the joint back to me. I take another hit. Already things are warping, certain objects blurring and others sharpening, like someone's messing with the focus on a camera. No wonder people still talk to Alex, even though he's a douche. He deals good stuff.
I don't know.
Because it's easy.
I guess you need to take things out on somebody.
The words are out of my mouth before I realize they're true. I take another hit and pass the joint back to Anna. I feel like everything's been amplified, like I can feel the heaviness of my arms and legs and hear my heart pumping and blood tumbling through my veins. And at the end of the day, it will all be silenced. At least until time skips back on its wheel and starts again. The bell rings, lunch is over. Anna says,
"Shit, shit, I have to be somewhere,"
and begins trying to gather up her stuff. She accidentally knocks over the Altoids tin, the bag of weed goes flying under the sink, and the papers flit and flutter everywhere.
"Shit!"
"I'll help," I say. We both get down on our hands and knees. My fingers feel numb and bloated, and I'm having trouble peeling the papers off the ground. This strikes me as hilarious, and Anna and I both start laughing, leaning on each other, gasping for breath. She keeps saying shit at intervals.
"Better hurry," I say.
All of the anger and pain from the past few days is lifting, leaving me feeling free and careless and happy. "Alex will be pissed." She freezes. Our foreheads are so close we're almost touching.
"How did you know I was meeting Alex?"
she says. Her voice is clear and low. I realize too late that I've screwed up. "Seen you sneaking back through Smoker's Lounge after 7th once or twice," I say vaguely, and she relaxes.
"You're not gonna tell anyone, are you?"
she asks, biting her lower lip.
"I wouldn't want..."
She stops herself, and I wonder if she's going to say something about Bridget, but she just shakes her head and continues gathering up the papers, working quickly now. The idea of telling on Anna Cartullo for sleeping with Alex after what I've just done, after Mr. Daimler, is hilarious. I've got no right to say anything to anybody. I'm smoking weed in a bathroom. I have no friends. My math teacher stuck his tongue down my throat. My boyfriend hates me because I won't sleep with him. I'm dead, but I can't stop living. The absurdity of everything really hits me in that second, and I start laughing again. Anna's gotten serious. Her eyes are big, bright marbles.
"What?"
she says. Are you laughing at me? I shake my head, but I can't respond right away. I'm laughing too hard to breathe. I've been kind of squatting next to her, but I'm shaking so hard, the laughter heaving through me, that I tumble backward, landing on my butt with a loud thump. Anna cracks a smile again. You're crazy, she says, giggling. I take a few gasping breaths. At least I don't barricade myself in bathrooms. At least I don't get stoned off half a joint. At least I don't sleep with Alex Lament. At least I don't have bitchy friends. At least I have friends. We're going back and forth, laughing harder and harder. Anna cracks up so hard she bends to the side and supports herself on one elbow. Then she rolls over all the way so she's just lying there on the bathroom floor making these hilarious yelping noises that remind me of a poodle. Every so often she snorts, which just makes me go off again. Let me tell you something, I say as soon as I can get the words out. Hear, hear. Anna pretends to pound a gavel and then snorts into her palm. I love the feeling of thickness around me. I'm swimming in murk. The green walls are water. I kissed Mr. Daimler. As soon as I say it, I die laughing again. Those must be the four most ridiculous words in the English language. Anna heaves herself up on one elbow. You did what? I bob my head up and down. We kissed. He put his hand up my shirt. He put his hand. I gesture between my legs. She shakes her head from side to side. Her hair whips around her face, reminding me of a tornado. No way, no way, no way. I swear to God. She leans forward so close I can smell her breath on my face. She's been sucking on an Altoid. That is sick. You know that, right? I know. Sick, sick, sick. He went to high school here, like 10 years ago. 8, we checked. She lets out a loud howl of laughter, and for a second, she lays her head down on my shoulder. They're all perverts, she says. The words quiet and directed straight into my ear. Then she pulls away and says, Shit, I am so dead. She stands up, steadying herself with one hand on the wall. She teeters for a moment as she stands in front of the mirror, smoothing down her hair. She takes a small bottle from her back pocket and squeezes a couple of drops into each eye. I'm still on the floor, staring up at her from below. She seems to be miles and miles away. I blurt out, You're too good for Alex. She's already stepped over me and on her way out the door. I see her back stiffen, and I think she's going to be angry. She pauses, one hand resting on the chair. But when she turns around, she's smiling. You're too good for Mr. Daimler, she says, and we both crack up again. Then she shoves the chair out of the way and tugs the door open, slipping into the hall. After she's gone, I sit with my head back, enjoying the way the room feels like it's doing loops. This is what it's like to be the sun, I think. And then I think how stoned I am. And then I think how funny it is to know that you're stoned, but not be able to stop thinking stoned thoughts. I see something white peeking out from underneath the sink. A cigarette. I lean down and find another one. Anna forgot to pick them up. Just then there's a sharp knock on the door, and I snatch both cigarettes up and get to my feet. As soon as I stand, the circling and the feeling of being underwater gets worse. It seems to take me forever to push the chair out of the way. Everything is so heavy. You forgot these, I say, holding the cigarettes up between two fingers as I open the door. It's not Anna, though. It's Ms. Winters, standing in the hallway with her arms crossed and her face pinched up so tightly it looks like her nose is a black hole and the rest of her face is getting slowly sucked into it. Smoking on school property is forbidden, she says, pronouncing each word carefully. Then she smiles, showing all of her teeth. The pugs.
In the Thomas Jefferson High School R&R, Rules and Regulations Handbook, it says that any student caught smoking on school property is subject to 3 days suspension. I know this by heart because all the smokers like to tear this page out of the handbook and burn it at the lounge, sometimes crouching and sticking their cigarettes in the flames to catch a light, as the words on the page curl and blacken and smoke into nothing. But I get off with only a warning. I guess the administration makes exceptions for students who have dirt on a certain vice principal and a certain gym teacher slash soccer coach slash mustache fan. Ms. Winters looked like she was going to have a massive coronary when I started going off about role models and my poor impressionable mind. I love that expression, as though everyone under the age of 21 has all the brain power of dental plaster. And the administration's responsibility to set an example, especially when I reminded her about page 69 in the R&R, it is forbidden to engage in lewd or sexually inappropriate acts in or around school property. That one I know because the page has been torn out and hung up about 1,000 times in various bathrooms on campus, the margins decorated with drawings of a decidedly lewd and sexually inappropriate nature. The administration was totally asking for it, though. Who puts a rule like that on page 69? At least the hour and a half I spent with Ms. Winters has sobered me up. The last bell has just rung, and all around me, students are sweeping out of classrooms, making way more noise than is necessary, shrieking, laughing, slamming lockers, dropping binders, shoving one another, a jittery, mindless, restless noise unique to Friday afternoons. I'm feeling good and powerful, and I'm thinking, I have to find Lindsay. She won't believe it. She'll die laughing. Then she'll put her arm around my shoulder and say, "You're a rock star, Samantha Kingston." And everything will be fine. I'm keeping an eye out for Anna Cartulo, too. While I was sitting in Ms. Winter's office, it occurred to me that we never switched shoes again. I'm still wearing her monster black boots. I swing out of Maine. The cold makes my eyes sting and a sharp pain shoots up my chest. February really is the worst month. A half dozen buses are idling in a line next to the cafeteria, engines choking and coughing, letting up a thick black wall of exhaust. Through the dirt-filmed windows, the pale faces of a handful of underclassmen, all slouched in their seats, hoping not to be seen, are featureless and interchangeable. I start cutting across the faculty lot toward Senior Alley, but I'm only halfway there when I see a big-ass silver Range Rover, its walls thudding with the bass of No More Drama, tear out of the alley and start gunning it toward upper lot. I stop, all of the good, buzzy feeling draining out of me quickly and at once. Of course, I didn't really expect Lindsay to be waiting for me, but deep down, I guess I was hoping for it. Then it hits me. I have no ride, nowhere to go. The last place I want to be is at home. Even though I'm freezing, I feel prickles of heat rising up from my fingers, crawling up my spine. It's the weirdest thing. I'm popular, really popular, but I don't have that many friends. What's even weirder is that it's the first time I've noticed. Sam! I turn around and see Tara Flute, Bethany Harps, and Courtney Walker coming toward me. They always travel in a pack, and even though we're kind of friends with all of them, Lindsay calls them the Pugs. Pretty from far away, ugly up close. What are you doing? Tara always has a perma-smile, like she's constantly auditioning for an ad for Crest toothpaste, and she turns it on me now. It's like 1,000 degrees below zero. I toss my hair over one shoulder, trying to look nonchalant. The last thing I need is for the Pugs to know I've been ditched. I had to tell Lindsay something. I gesture vaguely in the direction of Senior Alley. She and the girls had to jet out without me, some community service thing they do once a month. Lame. So lame, Bethany says, nodding vigorously. As far as I can tell, her only role in life is to agree with whatever has just been said. Come with us. Tara slips her arm in mine and squeezes. We're headed to La Villa to shop. Then we thought we'd hit up Kent's party. Sound good? I briefly run through my other options. Home is obviously out. I won't be welcome at Allie's. Lindsay has made that clear. Then there's Rob's, sitting on the couch while he plays Guitar Hero, making out a little bit, pretending not to notice when he tears another bra because he can't figure out the clasp, making conversation, and waving while his parents pack up the car for the weekend, pizza and lukewarm beer from the garage stash as soon as they're gone. Then more making out. No thank you. I scan the parking lot once more, looking for Anna. I feel kind of bad about taking off with her boots, but then again, it's not exactly like she's made an effort to find me. Besides, Lindsay always said a new pair of shoes could change your life. And if I was ever in need of a serious life change or afterlife change, whatever. It's now. Sounds perfect, I say. And if possible, Tara's smile gets a little wider, teeth so white they look like bone. As we leave school, I tell the pugs, I can't help but think of them that way, about my trip to the office and how Ms. Winters has been getting her freak on with Mr. Otto and how I got off without a detention because I promised her I would destroy a camera phone pic of one of her love sessions in Otto's office. Fabricated, obviously. There's no way I'd ever hang on to evidence of their coupling, much less in high digital format. Tara is gasping. She's laughing so hard. And Courtney's looking at me like I've just cured cancer or developed a pill that makes you grow a cup size. And Bethany covers her mouth and says, "Holy Mother of Lord Cocoa Puffs." I'm not exactly sure what that means, but it's definitely the most original thing I've ever heard her say. It all makes me feel good and confident again, and I remind myself that this is my day. I can do whatever I want. Tara, I squinch forward. Tara's car is a tiny two-door Civic, and Bethany and I are crushed in the back seat. Can we stop at my house for a second before we hit the mall? Sure. There's her smile again, reflected in the rear view like a piece of sky. Need to drop something? Need to get something, I correct her, shooting her my biggest smile back. It's almost 3 o'clock, so I figure my mom should be back from yoga. And sure enough, her car is in the driveway when we pull up to the house. Tara starts to pull in behind the Accord, but I tap her shoulder and gesture for her to keep going. She inches her car along the road until we're hidden behind a cluster of evergreens my mom had the landscaper plant years ago, after she discovered that our then neighbor, Mr. Horferly, liked to take midnight strolls on his property, totally in the buff. This is pretty much the answer to every problem you encounter in suburbia. Plant a tree and hope you don't see anyone's privates. I hop out of the car and loop around the side of the house, praying my mom isn't looking out one of the windows in the den or my dad's study. I'm banking on the fact that she's in the bathroom taking one of her infamously long showers before going to pick up Izzy at gymnastics. Sure enough, when I slide my key in the back door and slip into the kitchen, I hear the patter of water upstairs and a few high, warbling notes. My mom is singing. I hesitate for a split second long enough to place the tune, Frank Sinatra, New York, New York, and say a prayer of thanks that the pugs aren't witness to my mom's impromptu performance. Then I tiptoe into the mudroom where, as usual, my mom has deposited her enormous purse. It is sagging on its side. Several coins and a roll of breath mints have spilled out onto the washing machine, and a corner of her green Ralph Lauren wallet is just peeking out from under the thick leather loop of a shoulder strap. I remove the wallet carefully, listening all the while to the rhythm of the water upstairs, ready to cut and run if it stops flowing. My mom's wallet is a mess, too, crammed with photos, Izzy, me and Izzy, Pickle wearing a Santa's costume, receipts, business cards, and credit cards. Especially credit cards. I fish out the Amex carefully. My parents only use it for major purchases, so there's no way my mom will notice it's missing. My palms are prickly with sweat, and my heart is beating so hard it's painful. I carefully close up the wallet and slip it back into the purse, making sure it's in the exact same position as before. Above me, there's a final rush of water, a screeching sound as the pipes shutter dry, and then silence. My mom's Sinatra rendition drops off. Shower over. For a second, I'm so terrified I can't get my feet to move. She'll hear me. She'll catch me. She'll see me with the Amex in hand. Then the phone starts ringing, and I hear her footsteps heading out of the bathroom, crossing the hallway, hear her sing-songing, "Coming, coming!" In that second, I'm gone, slipping out of the mudroom, crossing the kitchen, out the back door, and running, running, running around the side of the house, the frost-coated grass biting my calves, trying to keep from laughing, clutching the cold plastic Amex so hard that when I open my palm later, I see it's left a mark. Normally at the mall, I have a very strict spending limit. Twice a year, my parents give me $500 for new clothes, and on top of that, I can spend whatever I make babysitting for Izzy or doing other servant-type things my parents ask me to do, like wrap presents for our neighbors at Christmas time, or rake the leaves in November, or help my dad unclog the storm drains. I know $500 sounds like a lot, but you have to keep in mind that Allie's Burberry galoshes cost almost that, and she wears those in the rain, on her feet. So, I've never been that big into shopping. It's just not that fun. Particularly when you're best friends with Allie Endless Limit credit card Harris and Lindsay, my stepdad, tries to buy my affection edge comb. Today, that problem is solved. First stop is BB, where I pick up a gorgeous spaghetti strap dress that's so tight I have to suck all the way in just to squeeze into it. Even then, Tara has to duck into the dressing room and help me zip up the last half inch. I kind of like how Anna's boots look with the dress, actually. Sexy and tough, like I'm a video game assassin or an action hero. I make Charlie's Angels poses at the mirror for a bit, shaping my fingers into a gun, pointing at my reflection and mouthing, "Sorry," pulling the trigger and imagining an explosion. Courtney nearly loses it when I hand over my credit card without even looking at the total. Not that I don't catch a glimpse. It's pretty hard to miss the big green $302.10 flashing on the register, blinking up at me like it's accusing me of something. My stomach gives a little hula performance as the saleswoman slides over the receipt for me to sign. But I guess all those years of forging my own doctor's notes and tardy excuses pays off because I give a perfect looping imitation of my mom's script, and the saleswoman smiles and says, "Thank you, Ms. Kingston," like I've just done her a favor. And just like that, I walk out with the world's most perfect black dress nestled in tissue paper at the bottom of a crisp, white shopping bag. Now I understand why Allie and Lindsay love shopping. It's much better when you can have whatever you want. "You're so lucky your parents give you a credit card," Courtney says, trotting after me as we leave the store. "I've been begging mine for years. They say I have to wait until I'm in college." "They didn't exactly give it to me," I say, raising one eyebrow at her. Her mouth falls open. "No way." Courtney shakes her head so fast her brown hair whips back and forth in a blur. "No way. You did not. Are you saying you stole?" "Shh. The Villa Mall is supposed to be Italian-themed, all big marble fountains and flagstone walkways. The sound gets bounced and zipped and mixed around, so it's impossible to make out what people are saying unless they're standing right next to you. But still, no point in pushing it now that I'm on a roll. I prefer to think of it as borrowing, anyway. "My parents would strangle me." Courtney's eyes are so wide, I'm worried her eyeballs will pop out. "They would kill me until I was dead." "Totally," Bethany says. We hit the Mac store next, and I get a full-on makeover from a guy named Stanley who's skinnier than I am, while the pugs try on different shades of eyeliner and get yelled at for breaking into the unopened lip glosses. I buy everything Stanley uses on me. Foundation, concealer, bronzing powder, eyeshadow prep, 3 shades of eyeshadow, 2 shades of eyeliner, 1 white for under the eye, mascara, lip liner, lip gloss, 4 different brushes, 1 eyelash curler. It's so worth it. I leave looking like I'm a famous model, and I can feel people staring at me as we walk through La Villa. We pass a group of guys who must be in college at least, and one of them mutters, "Hot."
Tara and Courtney are flanking me, and Bethany trails behind. I think, this is how Lindsay must feel all the time. Next is Neiman Marcus, a store I never go into unless Allie drags me, since everything costs $1 billion. Courtney tries on weird old lady hats, and Bethany takes pictures of her and threatens to post them online. I pick up this amazing forest green faux fur shrug that makes me look like I should be partying on a private jet somewhere, and a pair of silver and garnet chandelier earrings. The only snag comes when the woman at the cashier, Irma, according to her name tag, asks to see my ID. ID? I blink at her innocently. I so never keep it on me. Last year, my identity was stolen. She stares at me for a long time like she's thinking about letting it slide, then pops her gum and gives me a tight smile. She pushes the shrug and the earrings back across the counter. Sorry, Ellen. ID required for all purchases over $250. I prefer Ms. Kingston, actually. I give her a tight smile right back. Bitch. That gum-popping trick? Lindsay invented it. Then again, I'd be a bitch too if my parents had named me Irma. Suddenly inspired, I root around in my purse until I fish out my membership card to Hillsbridge Swim and Tennis, my mom's gym. I swear, security there is tighter than an airport. Like, obesity in America is somehow a terrorist plot, and the next big thing to go will be the nation's elliptical machines. And the card features a tiny picture of me, a membership ID number, and my last name and initials, Kingston, S-E. Irma screws up her face. What does the S stand for? My mind does that thing where it hiccups and then goes totally blank. Severus. She stares at me. Like in Harry Potter? It's German, actually. I should never have offered to read those stupid books to Izzy. You can see why I go by my middle name. Irma's still hesitating, biting the corner of her lip. Tara's standing right next to me, running her fingers over my Amex like some of the credit line will rub off on her. She leans forward and giggles. I'm sure you understand. Tara squints a little, like she's trying hard to make out the name tag from a distance of 6 inches. It's Irma, isn't it? Courtney comes up behind us, wearing a wide-brimmed hat with a gigantic feathered robin sprouting out of its side. Did people ever call you Wurma when you were little, or Squirma? Irma folds her mouth into a thin white line, reaches for my card, and swipes. Guten Tag, I say as we leave, the only German I know. Tara and company are still laughing about Irma as we pull out of the parking lot of La Villa. I can't believe it, Courtney keeps repeating, leaning forward to look at me like I'm suddenly going to disappear. This time they've given me shotgun automatically. I didn't even have to call it. I can't freaking believe it. I allow myself a small smile as I turn to the window and am momentarily startled by the reflection I see there. Huge dark eyes, smoke and shadow, full red lips. Then I remember the makeup. For a second, I didn't recognize myself. You're so awesome, Tara says, then palms the steering wheel and curses as we just miss the light. Please. I wave the air vaguely. I'm feeling pretty good. I'm almost glad Lindsay and I got into a fight this morning. Oh, shit. No way. Courtney beats on my shoulder as a huge Chevy Tahoe vibrating with bass pulls up next to us. Even though it's freezing, all the windows are down. It's the college guys from La Villa, the ones who checked us out earlier, who checked me out. They're laughing and fighting over something in the car. One of them yells, Mike, you're a pussy, pretending not to see us, the way guys do when they're just dying to look. They're so hot, Tara says, leaning over me to get a clearer view, then ducking quickly back to the wheel. You should get their number. Hello, there are four of them. Their numbers, then. Totally. I'm gonna flash them, I say, and I'm suddenly thrilled with the perfect, pure simplicity of it. I'm going to do it.
So much easier and cleaner than maybe I should or won't we get into trouble or oh my god, I could never. Yes. Three letters. I twist around to Courtney. Do you dare me? Her eyes are doing that bug thing again. Tara and Bethany stare at me like I've sprouted tentacles.
You wouldn't, Courtney says. You can't, Tara says.
I can. I would. And I'm going to. I roll down the window and the cold slams me, blots out everything, numbs my whole body so I just feel myself in bits and pieces, an elbow bobbing here, a thigh cramping, fingers tingling. The music pumping from the boys' car is so loud it makes my ears hurt, but I can't hear any words or melody, just the rhythm, throbbing, throbbing, so loud it's not even sound anymore, just vibration, feeling.
Hey!
At first I can only croak the word out, so I clear my throat and try again.
Hey! Guys!
The driver swivels his head in my direction. I can hardly focus, I'm so keyed up. But in that second, I see he's not that cute. Actually, he has kind of crooked teeth and a rhinestone stud in one ear like he's a rapper or something. But then he says,
Hey, cutie!
And I see his three friends lean over toward the window to look. One, two, three heads popping up like Jack's in the Box. Like the whack-a-mole game at Dave and Buster's. One, two, three, and I'm lifting my shirt, and there's a roar and a rushing, singing sound in my ears. Laughter? Screaming? And Courtney's yelling,
Go, go, go!
Then our tires screech and the car lurches forward, sliding a bit, the wind biting my face and the smell of scorched rubber and gasoline stinking up the air. My heart sinks slowly back from my throat to my chest, and the warmth and feeling comes back to my body. I roll up the window. I can't explain the feelings going through me. A rush like you get from laughing too hard or spinning too long in a circle. It's not exactly happiness, but I'll take it.
Priceless. Legendary.
Courtney's thumping the back of my seat, and Bethany's just shaking her head and reaching forward to touch me, eyes wide, amazed, like I'm a saint and she's trying to cure herself of a disease. Tara's screaming with laughter. She can barely watch the road. Her eyes are tearing up so badly. She chokes out,
Did you see their faces? Did you see?
And I realize I didn't see. I couldn't see anything. Couldn't feel anything but the roaring around me, heavy and loud. And it occurs to me that I'm not sure whether this is what it's like to be really, truly alive. Or this is what it's like to be dead. And it strikes me as hilarious. Courtney thumps me one more time, and I see her face rising behind me in the rearview mirror, red as a sun. And I start laughing, too. And the four of us laugh all the way back to Ridgeview, over 18 miles, while the world streaks past us in a smear of blacks and grays, like a bad painting of itself. We stop at Tara's house so everyone can change. Tara helps get me into my dress again, and after I slip on the fur shrug and the earrings and let my hair down, which is all wavy from being twisted up in a half knot all day, I turn to the mirror and my heart actually reindeer prances in my chest. I look at least 25. I look like somebody else. I close my eyes, remember standing in the bathroom when I was little as the steam from my shower retreated from the mirrors, praying for a transformation. I remember the sick taste of disappointment every time my face reemerged as plain as it ever was. But this time, when I open my eyes, it works. There I am, different and gorgeous, and not myself. Dinner's on me, of course. We go to Le Jardin de Ra, this super expensive French restaurant where all the waiters are hot and French. We pick the most expensive bottle of wine on the menu, and nobody asks to see our IDs, so we order a round of champagne. It's so good, we ask for another round, even before the appetizers come. Bethany gets drunk right away and starts flirting with the waiters in bad French, just because last year she spent the summer in Provence. We must order half the menu. Tiny, melt-in-your-mouth cheese puffs, thick slabs of pâté that probably have more calories than you're supposed to eat in a day, goat cheese salad and mussels in white wine and steak béarnaise and a whole sea bass with its head still attached and crème brûlée and mousse au chocolat. I think it's the best food I've ever tasted, and I eat until I can hardly breathe. And if I take one more bite, I really will bust my dress. Then, as I'm signing the check, one of the waiters, the cutest one, brings over 4 miniature glasses of sweet pink liqueur for the digestion. Except, of course, he says it, for the digestion. I don't realize how much I've had to drink until I stand up and the world swings wildly for a second, like it's struggling to find its balance. And I think maybe the world's drunk, not me, and start to giggle. We step out into the freezing air and it helps sober me up a little. I check my phone and see that I have a text from Rob.
What's up with you? We had a plan for tonight.
Come on, Sam. Courtney calls. She and Bethany have climbed into the back seat of the Civic. They're waiting for me to take shotgun again.
Party time.
I quickly write a text back to Rob. We're on. See you soon. Then I get in the car, and we head to the party. The party's just getting started when we arrive, and I beeline for the kitchen. Since it's still early and pretty clear of people, I notice a ton of details in the rooms I haven't seen before. The place is so stocked with little carved wood statues and funky oil paintings and old books, it could be a museum. The kitchen is brightly lit, and everything here looks sharp and separate. There are 2 kegs lined up directly inside the doorway, and most of the people are gathered here. It's basically guys at this point, plus some sophomores. They're huddled in clumps, gripping their plastic cups like they contain their whole life force. And their smiles are so forced, I can tell their cheeks are hurting.
Sam!
Rob sees me and does a double take as soon as I come in. He shoulders his way toward me and then backs me up against the wall, leaning a hand on either side of my head so I'm penned in.
I didn't think you were gonna show.
I told you I was coming. I put my hands on his chest, feeling his heartbeat skip under my fingers. It makes me sad for some reason. Did you get my text? He shrugs.
You were acting weird all day. I thought maybe you didn't like my rose.
Love ya. I'd forgotten about that. Forgotten about how upset I was. None of that matters now. They're just words, anyway. The rose was fine. Rob smiles and puts one hand on my head like I'm a pet.
You look hot, babe, he says. You want a beer?
I nod. The wine I had at the restaurant is already wearing off. I feel way too sober, too aware of my whole body, my arms hanging there like dead weights. Rob has started to turn away when he suddenly stops, staring down at my shoes. He looks up at me, half amused, half puzzled.
What are those?
He points at Anna's boots.
Shoes?
I point one of my toes and the leather doesn't even budge. This pleases me for some reason. You like them? Rob makes a face.
They look like army boots or something.
Well, I like them. He shakes his head.
They don't look like you, babe.
I think of all the things I've done today that would shock Rob. Cutting all my classes, kissing Mr. Daimler, smoking pot with Anna Cartulo, stealing my mom's credit card. Things that aren't like me. I'm not even sure what that means. I'm not sure how you know. I mentally try to add up all the things I've done in my life, but no clear picture emerges. Nothing that will tell me what kind of person I am, just a lot of haziness and blurred edges, indistinct memories of laughing and driving around. I feel like I'm trying to take a picture into the sun. All of the people in my memories are coming back featureless and interchangeable.